Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, second hour, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And my microphone seems to be a little on the low side. Would you check that? I may be incorrect here, but that's okay.
You're anyway, at the same spot we normally are.
All right.
Just means that you're having trouble hearing yourself.
Yeah, well, I can hear the music and I can hear the commercials, but I have trouble hearing me. Anyway, we talked about the GDP being up 2.3% on an annualized basis. There's a far more interesting number that is indicative of what may be going on in the big wide world out there. And that is the durable goods orders. Our wonderful Bureau of Economic Analysis came out with a report that demand for long-lasting U.S. factory goods rose in March by a nice 2.6%. That's just in March, which is really good. However, so you'd think, well, okay, the tariffs didn't have any effect on that. Well, actually it did, because if you strip out the previously contracted, but the orders actually came in March, orders for trucks, and the orders for airplanes, which were already pre-contracted prior to March, so they couldn't change the price, then what we saw was the durable goods order slightly decline. As a matter of fact,
declined 0.7%.
The tools, machine tools, which are the neutered ram of the industry.
The neutered ram wearing a belt. The bellwether.
The bellwether. The one that is one of the leading indicators of where the economy is going is machine tools. Machine tools are pretty important because they're used to make other stuff, and companies that see that they're going to have to make a lot of things out of metal in the future order more machine tools so they can make more stuff, unless there's some reason not to. Well, in this case, the orders actually declined rather than increased. This is one of those indicators we see that we've got really good momentum in the economy. The leading economic indicators across the board are saying through the end of 2018, it's pretty clear that barring some major catastrophe, we're not going to have a recession through the end of 2018. But there's a lot of really early indicators, like machine tools, that says that 2019 may be bumpy and 2020 is looking more and more like has the potential, not a certainty, but a potential to go into recession. Moody's is still saying 0.9% growth for the year 2019. They think we may not go into a recession, but they made that forecast before the trade war started cranking up. Mark Zandi at Moody's, who was one of those people who predicted the housing crisis very accurately and a lot of other things, he's been very, very accurate over the years, basically said that we're going to hit a rough spot in 2020, maybe late 2019, with the economy slowing down for a very simple reason. We are reaching constraints in the economy, and we just got a bunch of new stimulus. And when I say restraints, when we run out of truck drivers, we've hit a constraint. We can't grow any further in the ability to ship things, which means prices go up, but no more work gets done. And we're going to hit more and more of those constraints in the economy, and this is where economists look at that and say, okay, the economy is running faster than it can run, because we don't have the resources to keep it running at this acceleration. And when that happens, we overshoot and fall back. It's like an airplane that's trying to climb too fast. It doesn't have the engine power to get it to climb that fast. It can pull back. The pilot can pull back on the yoke, and the airplane can go up for a while, but eventually it's going to stall. Now, if the airplane tries to climb too quickly, it will hit a full-out stall, not just kind of level off. And there's deep concern there about that. Now, throw in the tariffs, and the potential is there for a hard landing. And it could be a global hard landing if we get into a full-fledged trade war, which we're getting closer and closer to. That's one of the reasons you saw Macron and Merkel.
They're both showing up in D.C. because
They want exemptions.
They say, hey, you're doing this to the whole world, but we're your buddies. We supported you in Afghanistan. We supported you in Iraq. And now you're going to be causing our business to not do so well. What's going on here?
At least Macron came out of there saying he doesn't think that they're going to get an exemption in Europe for the aluminum steel tariffs, which is going to hurt them and
us. It will also help us.
It will raise prices. It won't help us. It'll hurt us,
yes.
It'll raise prices for steel and aluminum here, which slows down activity in the United States and increases inflation, which causes the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates to keep inflation from getting out of control, which causes business to further slow down. All of these factors are starting to come together in a relatively unpleasant way. What's really odd is if you go back to the time when we were in the Great Recession, the head of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, was begging Congress to cut taxes.
Yeah.
And they were saying, no, the deficits are too high. We can't have high deficits. We don't want to increase our debt. And he said, well, if you cut taxes, then there'll be more money in people's pockets, and that will help us get out of the recession faster.
Yes, your deficits will be there, but you'll have a surplus at some point, and you can raise taxes again when things go well.
And now that we are out of the recession and the economy is going gangbusters,
Time to pay off debt, not take more.
Right. Congress has decided that it's a good idea to lower taxes and raise the deficit.
Now, having said that, both of us are going to benefit quite nicely from the tax cut. We're very happy personally and for our clients. When we look at how to plan for an individual with these tax cuts, it's fantastic. We'd better take advantage of it while we can.
And we are taking advantage of it.
But don't be blind in the middle of this. Because it benefits you, because it benefits us, we cannot be blind to the long-term damage that it does to our economy. And that's important. If you're a business owner in any way, if you do something to give yourself a short-term boost that's going to have a long-term problem associated with it, don't close your eyes to the problem. Know it's there. Take the boost if you need it.
In essence,
if you have to.
Let me boil this down in the simplest way, in most accurate way to understand it. If you got an increase in your take-home, you got more money in your pocket. Every penny you got in your pocket, the government had to go out and borrow. And because we pretty well saturated U.S. Loaning capacity, the money that's showing up in your pocket was borrowed mostly from China.
So at the same time, we're saying to China, you're not allowed to export to us. We're not going to import any more items from you except money. And that, by the way, shows up on the same GDP numbers. It shows up on the balance of trade issues. The money that they're giving us in a loan is an import from China that we are paying them for.
So apparently, with the majority of the tax advantage, the cash flow from the tax cut going to people with upper income, which balances out the fact they have upper income, they get a lot more money. One of the reasons they're not spending the money is they're not stupid.
Yeah. They got that money because they're not stupid.
They recognize that this is not sustainable. This is going to break. And when it breaks, it's not going to be real pleasant, and we're going to experience decreased cash flows. So we better save that money. We better pay down our debts now that it's good time, which is causing the government to not see increased, by the way, this is a really profound thing to get a hold of right away. The supply side theory, which, by the way, is a perversion of the real supply side economic theory, is that a tax cut causes people to spend more money, which causes more people to make money, which causes greater tax revenues to the government. But we're past that point.
It can work in a lot of circumstances.
But
this
not this
circumstance
one.
Is not one of them.
So what we've seen is a really interesting combination. We got a tax cut and a slowdown in spending, but not actually a slowdown. The growth dropped below inflation rates. The growth in personal spending has now dropped below inflation rates, which means we're not getting an increase in tax revenue as a result of the tax cut. And that's probably, that makes really good sense because the Bush tax cuts had exactly the same effect. When
except in capital gains. Capital
gains. And that was temporary.
And that was temporary. You have this big boost in capital gains.
Sure.
Anytime you lower a capital gains rate, you're going to get a big temporary boost in revenue to the government.
Well,
because people that have been waiting, no, I'm not just going to let this go to my kids when I die, and then nobody's going to pay any tax on it. Lower it down to 10%, and they say, well, I'll take the money now, and I'm going to use that money for fun stuff.
Alan Greenspan, who's one of the more brilliant economists we've had in high places in a long time, stated again and again and again to Congress, ideally, we would have no capital gains tax at all.
Right.
We would simply have income tax. If you have an income tax, because when the people get capital gains, they ultimately need to spend the money or invest it. And if they invest it, it goes back into the economy and makes things grow. And if they spend the money, then they pay income taxes on it.
Now, ultimately, I would like to take that a step further and get rid of all taxes associated with income and all do it just on transactions, just on the purchase of something, a sales tax. That's a pipe dream because it removes so much power from the federal government. The U.S. Congress likes to be able to say this industry gets a tax cut or gets a tax increase. It's really hard to do that at the convenience store, at Walmart, figure out who you are and say, no, you pay more than the person standing behind you or in front of you.
Yeah, well, I've got my questions of whether that would work, but that's all right.
It works in Texas.
Yes, it works in Texas because, among other things, Texas is a net receiver of federal income tax money.
It was not during the recession.
Really?
In the recession, it was a net unreceiver. We had a lot of money coming to us, and a lot of people were losing money. We did well during the recession. So we were net an exporter of money to the federal and then the rest of the country through taxes.
Agreed. Okay. There's not much we can do about that. I don't think it's going to change anything. It's basically a value-added tax might work.
I can dream. A sales tax, the fair tax, I can dream. It's only a dream. Only a dream.
It's one of those things that would take a constitutional amendment, and I don't think it's going to happen. Because we do have a constitutional amendment to have an income tax, and if we had a national sales tax of any kind, it would probably take a constitutional amendment.
I think they can use the same. I don't know. I'd have to look into it. I don't think it's going to take a constitutional amendment. It would take an act of Congress, and the danger would be that they would keep the income tax as well as the new sales tax.
Hey, I want to talk about something totally different.
Okay, let's do it.
Jay Clayton, who is not exactly a household name, is the relatively new chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and he seems to be a very highly qualified, thoughtful person. And the Securities and Exchange Commission, the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, just came out with two proposals for comment. One was aimed at the commissioned broker-dealer industry, the broker-dealers, and the other one was aimed at registered investment advisors. But the bottom line to it is, he stated something that when he testified to Congress before the Financial Services and General Government Subcommittee of the House Committee on Appropriations. Boy, is that a mouthful. But that was on April, that was Thursday when he testified. And he made some very, very, very profound and I think important statements. He stated that that the SEC has gone around and questioned a lot of people to see if they understand when they receive investment advice what it amounts to. And they weren't really surprised, but they validated that the vast majority of people, and that means nearly everybody, by the way, doesn't realize that if they go to somebody who is working for a broker-dealer. Now, what's a broker-dealer? Broker-dealer is Merrill Lynch, A.G. Edwards. Does A.G. Edwards still exist? I don't know. Anyway, anybody who's working for a company that sells financial products is a representative of a broker-dealer. They traditionally are called brokers,
Wells Fargo. A.G. Edwards is Wells Fargo now.
Okay.
So Wells Fargo is also a broker-dealer.
And Merrill Lynch doesn't really exist. It's Bank of America. But anyway, if you go to some place where somebody is employed by a commercial company and you go in and they say, I'm a financial advisor, they are, in fact, salespeople with, and he may, this is his statement, it's not mine, large conflicts of interest and are capable of legally and most of the time do sell things that are of greater benefit to them and to their employer than they are to the person they're selling it to. Well, that's just normal behavior. If you go to a store, they're not going to sell you the best. They're not going to try to get you the best price. They're going to get them the best profit to them.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of the definition of what stores do for a living. It's the definition of in profit.
If you go to a John Deere dealership and you want to buy a lawnmower or a riding lawnmower, they're not going to tell you that at Walmart you can. I'm not sure if you can, but at Walmart there's one that you can get cheaper that's just as good, made by the same people. That's their job, is to make money for their employers, no matter how nice they are. He said people don't understand. They believe, the vast majority of the American public believes, that they have a legal right to non-conflicted investment advice from these people, but in fact, there's two groups of people out there, he said. One group is conflicted, is legally conflicted, and does not have to reveal the conflict. They don't have to reveal that their employer pays them a bonus for selling this product, or allows them to go to a convention for selling this product but not another product that's less expensive. And then he said there's investment advisors, and he said they actually, people believe that an investment advisor, which is a fiduciary, is obligated under law to have no conflicts. He said that's not true. They're just obligated to disclose their conflicts.
Right.
And the conflicts can't be material. And, so there's a huge difference. And this is something I really don't think people get, the difference between a financial advisor. And that's why he's saying brokers can no longer, that the proposal is to have no longer allow brokers representatives, broker dealer representatives, to call themselves financial advisors.
Or anything with the word advisor.
And I love that.
And the reason is, let me throw this out there. There was an exemption in the law when investment advisor fiduciaries were made. This is a group of people that have to work in the client's best interest. They said, okay, we don't have to apply this same huge, very, very onerous fiduciary standard on brokers, because their advice is incidental to the sale of a security. It's incidental. If you want to buy a stock, they say you should buy that stock. Or don't buy that stock, it's not a good price. So the SEC has said they don't need to be fiduciaries. If their advice is incidental to a sale, then they shouldn't call themselves advisors. Maybe they should, with an exception, incidental advisor. That might be a... Anyway, we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Okay, guys, excuse me, enjoy your show. There was an article in the Wall Street on Thursday. It said, backfire possible as financial rules ease. And the question I have, it says in the U.S., they're promoting pro-cyclical regulations, it says, which pushes the economy in the direction it's already headed. And then there's a bunch of other countries are doing counter-cyclical boosts to bank capital. Can you explain the difference in the two? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you, sir.
You want me to get that?
Sure.
Okay. Pro-cyclical is what we were talking about with the tax cuts.
This is like if you're on a bicycle. No, that's not. No. It's a different kind of cyclical.
The thing is, when the economy is in recession, is the time to relax things, allow money to flow more freely, make things free up where people can do business because in a recession, people don't want to do business. And once things start getting hot, once things start rolling and you're starting to hit constraints in the economy, the regulatory regime should tighten up and try to slow things down a little bit and make people, because what happens in the top of an economy, which we're crawling into right now, the top of an economic, a cyclical economic cycle, that's redundant, but it's true, is that this is where the scams and the bubbles and the excesses begin to appear, like the tech bubble or the housing bubble. They don't appear at the bottom during recessions. As a matter of fact, during recessions is when they're realized. There's an old saying, Philip Corray, I think, was the guy who originated it, said that if you don't know who's not wearing a swimming suit until the tide goes out. And so what we're doing in politically in the United States today is during the downturn, during the literally during the Obama administration, when the Democrats had control of Congress, we tightened regulatory affairs and made it more difficult for banks and financial services and so on to do business. Now that we got everything's going like gangbusters and we have Republicans dominating the federal government, we're loosening regulatory restrictions. We're loosening fiscal restrictions. We're pouring more money into it. In other words, we're accelerating an already growing economy after inadvertently damping an already shrinking economy. And that is called pro-cyclical. Ideally, and this is every major economist that has won a Nobel Prize since I can remember, has all agreed that during downturns, you slack off, you back off and allow the economy to run more freely through regulatory affairs, through interest rates, through fiscal, you lower taxes, you do whatever you can do to get the economy running back up to speed. And then ideally, once the economy comes up to speed and we start hitting the bump limits, the federal government ideally should start slowing the economy down. Why? Because if we overshoot on the upside, the downside gets worse as a result. Every study in history shows that.
Let me give an example of that, because that was very true. What you just said was absolutely true, but it's hard to follow because it's a concept. All right, let's say we had a big bust in the housing market.
We did.
Okay, so we say that. It happened. Housing market is recovering. What caused the boom that led to the housing market booming and then busting? The big boom was because a lot of people needed to buy houses. The bigger boom was that the government loosened regulations in the middle of that first boom to say everybody needs a house. And we will support that and endorse that and give benefits to banks that are giving these loans. So they loosened regulations in a good time period, in a time period of lots of sales, so that they could increase the profits in an already maturing cycle. And what that did was it did increase profits drastically for the short term, but they were imaginary profits because people didn't pay those loans, because the loosening of restrictions allowed people that couldn't afford to buy something, which caused losses, not profits. And that's what happens if you loosen regulations at the top of a cycle. You can increase the top, you can make it go further, farther, but you're almost guaranteeing the downside to be worse.
Let me give you a couple of specific examples. During the boom, there were officials in exchanges, not because there's no exchange for mortgage securities per se, but out of the Chicago Board of Trade, I think it is. Anyway, one of the exchanges out of Chicago that's a regulated exchange. The chairperson of that exchange went before Congress and said, we need to have regulations slowing down and regulating the issuance of mortgage securities. And she was basically drummed out of Congress and forced to resign for daring to want to slow down the housing industry's issuance of bonds and the building of lots of new houses for people who couldn't afford them. Because those people who were building the houses were paying lots of taxes, they were causing a boost to the economy, and they had lots of lobbying money to convince Congress that they shouldn't have any restrictions on what they did, because the free market, and believe me, this is Alan Greenspan included,
right,
said this too.
Free market's important.
Free market would regulate itself.
Well, the problem is if the government steps in and unregulates a free market in the middle of a boom, they're not good at regulating themselves in the middle of a boom. They're really good at regulating themselves in the middle of a bust. And that's the reality anywhere. If you're just getting started selling cars, you just bought your own dealership, you've got cars out on the lots, are you likely to make a lot of really, really big risky bets when you don't have any profits yet? Well, the whole thing may have been a risky bet. But beyond that, you're going to make some pretty good decisions in your own business model to try to get the right kind of profit. Because things are tight. When things get not tight and you start making decisions, you're more likely to make bad decisions hoping that this not tight environment stays. This is one of those areas that's important for people to recognize. Anybody that's listened to us for very long knows that we think that private business tends to make a lot better decisions regulatorily and in other ways than the government. But it's a tendency, not an always. Because that same tendency to make better decisions for profit can also lead to really bad circumstances for employees. You know, the unions came up for a really good reason at the turn of the 20th century. The beginning of the 20th century, unions fought hard to become recognized nationally as a legal enterprise to fight some very clear wrongdoing on the parts of private business, where they just weren't paying people. They would pay them in wooden chips that you could only buy from the company store. And we hear about this argument a lot. Some regulation from the government is necessary to keep corporations from putting profit way ahead of everything else.
Let me give you an example of exactly what that article was talking about. When we got the tax cut at the end of last year, the president said, and the leaders in the Republican Party in the House of Representatives and the Senate all said, this is about jobs.
Yeah.
We need more jobs. We need to create more jobs in the United States. But let me read you two articles. Let me read you a couple of headlines. U.S. jobless claims dropped to lowest level since 1969. That was economic data. It's from the Wall Street Journal on April 26th. U.S. chart book, housing and labor markets face supply constraints. That's April 23rd, 2018. Those are not as a result of the tax cuts, by the way. Those were already happening.
You can see the trend, and
the tax cut
didn't change with the tax cut. We wouldn't have time to yet.
So we basically have got something approaching 100% employment in the United States. We've got literally have more job openings in the United States than we have unemployed people that are capable of working. Even if the labor participation rate went up to where it was before the Great Recession.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, as the 70-year-old we heard about last hour,
went back to work.
Came back out of retirement. If all those people went to work, we would still have more jobs than we have people to fill them in the United States. Yet we were sold on the idea that the tax cut was a good idea because it creates more jobs. And by the way, the other thing was when the president announced the steel and aluminum tariffs, his press secretary, and on another occasion, he said, this is about jobs. This is creating jobs in the United States. And again, I want to emphasize this. We have more jobs open in the United States than we have people to fill them. But the government is still in the process of trying to create more job openings. We've already got more than we've got people to fill them.
Let me throw this in.
That's called pro-cyclical.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy this. It's another way of looking at it. When people watch the History Channel, they hear this kind of analysis regularly when it comes to wars. We always train to fight the last war. And whatever that war is, the next war is going to be different. And we've been training for the wrong war, so we got to go into this and completely rechange what we're doing. People talked about Vietnam as being training to fight the last war. And then after Vietnam, we were training to fight Vietnam. And then the Gulf War happened, and so on. When it comes to the government, they have a lag effect. Part of the reason why Trump was elected was because of the Great Recession. Our president was elected because he recognized some things that the current politicians, the politicians at that time during the recession, were blind to. What about jobs? How do we help people? What can we do to make this work? So that voice, which we hungered for as a country during the recession, when it was heard after the recession, we said, finally, somebody's speaking to us.
Right.
So we have this politicians get elected based on the last crisis, not the next one. And the next crisis, and this is just, there's no real way to fix this concept because we never know what the next crisis is going to be. But what we can say is don't fight the last crisis after it's already been surmounted. Once we're done with it, then we could say, all right, how do we prevent it from happening again? But don't treat a healthy economy like an unhealthy one when in the recession. I've got to say this as clear as possible. People heard us asking for this again and again and again and again. Lower the corporate tax rate. Lower income tax rates. Increase spending. We got to get this done. And people would call up and be so angry with us for talking about that.
For increasing the deficit.
For increasing the deficit. And today, when people are, when government did what we were begging them to do, we're now saying, well, you shouldn't have done it then.
It's very much like an engine that's running, and a steam engine is the prime example, except people don't understand steam engines anymore. Once an engine, engines have governors that when they rev up to a certain speed, it cuts back on the fuel supply to the engine to slow it down. And if the engine starts lugging, like on your lawnmower or something, if the engine starts lugging because it's undergoing a great deal of stress and it's having to work really hard, the governor on the engine increases the amount of fuel going to the engine so that it will speed up. It will get back to a fair speed. One of the problem that we're running into in the United States, and this has a lot to do with our democracy and the lags inherent in our democracy.
Yeah, it just takes us a while to digest information.
We tend to goose the engine and pour more fuel in when the engine is already running at top safe speed. And then when the engine starts to slow down, we tend to cut the fuel off and pull it back. Now, the Federal Reserve tends to do the opposite and catches a lot of flack over it, which is why the Federal Reserve Act made the Federal Reserve independent of Congress and of the president. Now, the reason for that is basically Congress overwhelmingly voted to create the Federal Reserve and make it independent from Congress in an effort to say, save us from ourselves.
Right. And this is important because during the era of the Great Recession, we talked about three great experiments going on. And the Europeans chose austerity. So their lawnmower was under a great strain. They were going through really, really thick grass, and it was really slowing down the engine, and they cut gas. They said, let's turn the gas off. And they stalled their engine, and they had to restart it and installed it again and restart it and stalled again. We put the choke on, and we said, all right, we need to get some more gas in here. And the Chinese, they went to an extreme and turned the choke on and then put some nitro in there as well. And it's led to some big inflation in China, very large inflation in China. So we took the middle ground of, all right, the Federal Reserve released money into the economy. That kind of did the governing. The lawnmower wasn't under as much strain anymore. We were saying at that point, don't cut back spending, increase spending on the government side, lower taxes. We didn't get much of that. We got a little bit of that. Both Obama and George W. Bush did a surplus package. We had TARP. Those were government efforts to govern more, get more gas into the engine. But it wasn't enough. And we tightened up restrictions really, really hard right in the middle of the recession. Dodd-Frank went way too far. But to kind of unilaterally pull back all the things that Dodd-Frank did, some of the things it did were to prevent the next crisis. And if we throw it out saying we don't need that anymore, we're already recovered, then we might have some real problems ahead. This is difficult because it's hard to get a popularly elected group to come and look at a forward-facing problem. How do we correctly regulate banks at a time when banks are flush with cash, which means they're able to lobby as much as they want? You can get restrictions in on banks when they are short on cash, when they're losing money and failing and they're coming hat in hand to the U.S. government for money. You can get restrictions on there. So in some ways, it may be good that we over-regulated. That's kind of a stretch. We need to take some time in a good time period to plan ahead. That's how we wrote the Constitution.
Well,
you know, if we think about what might we face in the future rather than trying only to fix things that are kind of already fixed.
Well, actually, the Constitution was a hodgepodge thrown together, and I think either by an act of God or pure blind luck, we
or
worked
some of all of that.
Because, I mean, you know, you think about it, we had to fight a civil war to resolve certain aspects of the Constitution.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't – one of the things we tend to forget is from what was it, 1889, I think it was, the Constitution was ratified until 1789
yeah.
to 1865. We were a very unstable nation with an ineffective Constitution, and we still treated a very significant portion of our population as property. Now, you want to carry that a little further. I don't remember when women received the right to vote.
After African-American males received the right to vote.
It was in the 20th century.
It was in the 20th century.
But we didn't really affect a democracy in the United States, in that half of the people in the United States were denied the right to vote until the 20th century.
1920.
In 1920. And think about this just a second. We had the Constitution that we accept today as being the Constitution really didn't take effect until 1920.
And then after that, we had Prohibition, which was part of the
right.
Constitution.
That was
a false step. We've got an amendment that has another amendment saying ignore the amendment above.
Yeah, well, that was – there's everything I've ever read on that indicates that the women getting the vote is why we had Prohibition. And that's – but the point is this – we look at what goes on around the world. We look at the imperfections in our government, and there are major imperfections in our government and the government around the world. It's like Winston Churchill said about it very clearly.
Yeah.
He said this is the worst form of government he could think of except for all the rest.
Yeah, democracy is the ugliest, worst form of democracy in the world
except for all the others,
yeah.
So we got commercials to do?
We do.
Okay.
We've got some commercials we got to play, and then we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join our conversation, the phone number to reach us in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake.
McClure, and the telephone number in here is 254, if you need to dial long distance, 773-1400, if you'd like to call and ask questions or make comments or anything else that has to do with an investment or financial or economic nature, presuming that wherever you are today is Saturday the 28th or Sunday the 29th, if you're on the other side of the Pacific Ocean from us, of April.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about one factor. I didn't see any good headlines on it. I see multiple headlines that you have to add together to get this. Business spending's up, consumer spending's down.
Well, it's not actually down. It just only rose 1.1%.
Yeah, consumer confidence is down.
Yeah, well.
And
yeah.
Spending is slowing. The growth is slowing.
Right. So basically, businesses are spending a lot of money buying stuff.
Right. And that's because tax cuts were bigger for the business.
Mm-hmm.
Businesses have been waiting to buy things, and they're allowed to get a full write-off for the whole purchase this year. So it's happening. But something that's really important to understand here is that consumer spending is what drives our economy. And we've just boosted corporate spending and very slightly boosted consumer spending. We need to keep an eye on that, because when corporate spending far outpaces consumer spending, when the corporations are spending a lot of money and continue to spend a lot of money, it means that prices tend to go up, unless there's a tax cut. In this case, there was a tax cut, so spending's going to go there. But this is what happens behaviorally. When you get into a spending mindset, whether you're personal at home or corporate, and there's a group of people at a big business that are hired to do this. When you get into a spending mindset, it's hard to stop, which is good for the economy. When you get into a saving mindset, it's hard to spend. We were talking about this at the beginning of the first hour. Consumers are saving and paying down debt right now. They're saving money and paying down debt, which is very smart. This is a good thing for them to do. It may not be the best thing for the economy, but it's really, really good personally. And long term, if everybody does this, it will be good for the economy because it will allow us to make rational purchases. It will allow us to buy things without going deep into debt. Debt allows the economy to grow faster. If you're buying a house, most people need a mortgage. So debt is a good thing. We need to be able to get debt so that we can buy a house and be more productive. But you don't need lots and lots of debt. You don't need five houses all on debt. You don't need mortgages on all your properties because that puts a lot more threat to the economy long term. The economy is threatened because if you fail, it's not just one loan that you fail on. You fail on all of them. So rational approaches to saving, to paying down debt, cause a much smoother economy where you don't see the big jumps up and jumps or in drops of the economy. If we can as a group rationalize the way we spend, it's better for everything. What tends to happen, though, is that as one part of the economy begins to get rational, the other side goes the other way. So corporate spending needs to be watched carefully. They're still flush with cash. They just got a lot more cash. They're spending. The danger is that they continue to spend when they shouldn't anymore. And the best example of that is that if things are going well, and this is something that's happening in the local Central Texas area, we're starting to see housing prices come down. We're in a boom time for housing prices, but we're seeing them start to drop. The reason why we're seeing them start to drop is that there are a lot of different, completely independent home building corporations and independent people, sole proprietorships, building a lot of houses. They're not consulting with each other. They just looked around and said, it's a good business opportunity. Housing prices have been coming up a long time. I need to get some houses on the market. I'm going to build them. But they're all doing it at the same time. And this is the danger. We tend to overbuild because we don't, because of competition, because we're not talking to each other to say, how many are you building over there? I don't want to overbuild. We tend to overbuild, which is good for the consumer. The end of this cycle might have cheaper houses. People will be able to afford a better house because they were overbuilt. We're already starting to see that happen. The danger on the corporate side with corporate spending way up is they get into that mindset and ignore what their competitors are doing. Market research is an absolute must. It doesn't matter if you're a small business building houses or if you are a large business with international ties. The idea here is very, very carefully inspect what your competitors are doing so that you're not doing exactly the same thing that they are doing and coming to market at the same time with your ultra nice thing that you expect high profits from. You may have to lower those profit expectations if you're not careful. So that's the big thing. If you're in business, strategize. Look what your competitors are doing and make sure that you're not about to hit the market at the same time that they are. That's just kind of common sense, but unfortunately it's not so common. We get wrapped up in what we're doing individually and get excited about what we're doing, and it's a good idea, but you may not be the only one with the idea. So keep that in mind. All right.
Well, it's coming towards the end of the second hour, so let's kind of wrap this up a little bit.
Good idea.
We've still got about 8 minutes left in the hour, so you're still welcome to give us a call at 773-1400. But here's what the consensus of the many, many, many opinions and quality economists' opinions that we read is saying right now, and it's summarized very nicely at Moody's Analytics, except you got to pay a lot of money every year to read Moody's Analytics, which, by the way, indicates it's probably worth something. And that is that 2018 looks like a good year. We are in, I know technically I may not be correct, please forgive me, But we're in a correction right now. We're in a market correction. The market is definitely down from where it was 3 months ago. It's flat from the beginning of the year. And we've got to, we certainly are, we're down at least 7% from its peaks, maybe a little more. But it isn't an indication that we're headed into a bear market. There's one of the big indicators is what are retail investors doing. Well, the retail investors are pulling out of equities and buying into bonds, and interest rates are going up, which indicates that retail investors are doing in mass pretty much what they normally do, which is exactly the wrong thing. Equities, based on historic price-to-earnings ratios in the United States, are either fair or below fair price right now, which means it's still a good idea because and we have earnings. We just had earnings grow at 25%, and the forecasts are that earnings will continue to grow. They may not grow 25% in the next quarter, but they're going to grow. And the issue is that it's a good time to be in the stock market. It is a poor time to be going into the bond market because the Federal Reserve is reportedly now considering four interest rate increases this year instead of three. As interest rates go up, bonds get beat up. They get hurt. Bonds have a nice negative return for the year, whereas stocks are flat. So, of course, people are bailing out of stocks and buying bonds. This is an indication we're nowhere near a bear market. When you see that reverse, when you see the market take off into a bull stage, and I really believe, barring some unexpected event, we'll get back into the what is obviously a bull market, make new highs before the end of the year, and maybe go into 2019 still rocking and rolling, then when you see the retail investors start to sell bonds like there's no tomorrow and buy stocks like their tomorrow will be full of gold, then is a time to get worried. Right now, the wall of worry is very high. The stock market looks like a very profitable place to be, and that's, of course, barring some unexpected event. Now, let me give you an example of what I mean by an unexpected event. Sooner or later, there's going to be a massive earthquake in California. That is not forecastable. When it does,
it's
the stock market...
It's forecastable, just not to a given date.
We don't know when it's going to happen. When it does, I guarantee the stock market will crater temporarily before it does really well. Definitely put the United States in a recession right now if there was a major earthquake in California. We can't forecast those things. We don't try to. But what I can say is stocks are either below, by many measurements that we use, using forward estimates, stocks are below their historic norms in price. Bonds are above their historic norms in price. So it's a good time to be invested. Be optimistic about the economy. The economy is going like gangbusters, and through the end of 2018, every indication indicates it will continue to do well through the end of 2018. We'll look at 2019 when it starts getting a little closer, but despite all of the bad news that we've been kind of harping on in this, and there is long-term bad news, most of that bad news won't really bear fruit until 2020, and that we'd like to look further down the road and see what's happening. So hang in there. Stay invested. Keep on plodding along. Don't try to knock the ball out of the park.
I'm going to give some good news, although it sounds kind of macabre. Yale neuroscientists have taken the heads of pigs from slaughterhouses.
Good. We didn't need those in the slaughterhouses anyway. No. It's good that neuroscientists are doing something useful.
They restored the blood flow to those brains and were able to keep the pigs' brains alive in a decapitated form for a week. Just think about that for a moment, if you will. We're moving forward in medical research in areas that are quite likely to extend our life expectancy into very, very far distant futures.
I hope nobody from PETA was listening to that.
Yeah, and that's part of the thing is that when people from major news organizations contacted the neuroscientists at Yale, they said, we have no comment. That was for a journal for research purposes, and we're not commenting to the media. Now, they didn't kill the pigs. The pigs were being killed at the slaughterhouses, but it goes to the next point. They've restored the brain to life It's like sensory deprivation to the maximum.
Well, I know it could still smell, and it could. I don't know if it wasn't breathing, it couldn't smell very well. It could still hear.
Could hear, possibly see.
But a person has a broken neck and they are paralyzed from the neck down, they can't feel anything either.
So this is where, you know, the ability to do this, they're talking about doing a head transplant. This is a scheduled event, a human head being transplanted. This concept, we're growing things in the lab and we're able to do things we've never done before. So that's really cool and something that I thought was worth pointing out, because it's going to make changes to how we see the future. There's a lot more than that going on. New forms of batteries, new forms of power, fusion technology is, they have reached on several experiments. More energy than they put into it has come out of it. It's very expensive at this point, but there are a lot of competing firms heading down the road, and I expect within the next decade that we're going to see fusion power be a real thing, which is fantastic because the radiation from it is minuscule compared to fission power. Okay, so we're about out of time for this week. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we give investment advice on a fiduciary basis through the Personal Wealth Coach to people of high net worths. And the number to reach us locally and get voicemail on the weekend is
254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
And you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly. We actually read those things. Jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com if you want to go to our website. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth.